Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
So what I'll be speaking about briefly is how did this business of academic freedom come about and what does it mean at King's? What is the new law and what implications does it have for us and why is it so complex? And in all of this complexity, how do we find a way forward and what does it mean for us as a university? And I will leave time for your questions and your suggestions that Claire and I will take together. So I'll do that through these four dates. And I want you to know these dates because they're critical. So we'll start with the first, noon, 8th of October, 1831. Why is that important? Noon, 8th of October, 1831. In London. Founding of King's College. That's exactly. You are here because of that date, and in fact, it was here that King's College London was founded, and that's what it looked like. Now you might find this very surprising. Yes, the Thames came right up to Somerset House, and this is where you are sitting now, here, a little bit behind that. That's St. Paul's. None of that was built. The embankment did not exist, and they had a wonderfully boyish principal. That's Principal William Otter. Sorry, don't have it anymore. So some things have changed, but some things haven't. That was the building, pre-photograph days. That's the chapel, looks quite the same. So as I said, some things stay the same, but some things change. How many here use the pronoun she or her? Raise your hands. You were not invited to the party. It was only for those who were explicitly men. How many here are international? Sorry, not invited to the party. King's was largely for people from the UK. Now, that was partly because people couldn't travel as much. So it was a restricted kind of an organization, and it wouldn't have a principal like me. You know, I'm a person of color, I'm not Anglican. So things have changed. Things have moved on. And in fact, they didn't only just move on from 200 years ago. I would say 50 years ago at King's, talking about decolonization would have been difficult. It would have been alien. Today, we engage in that debate, meaning to understand. Why do I point that out to you? I point that out to you to say things change, but they change because of ideas. At some point in time, there would have come an idea that the sectarianism within Christianity wasn't a good thing. Then there would have come an idea that we need to move out to people of all faiths, then to people of all different countries, then to a global community. That didn't happen overnight, but it happens, and it happens because of ideas. So let me take you to the next date. Saturday, 6 p.m., 22nd of October, 4004 B.C. Why is that important? There you go, our professor of theology. Anyone knows? They probably didn't hear you. Why is that date important? No one knows that. Because that is when the world was created. I'm not making it up. In 1830, when King's College was founded, if I would have stood here and any of you did not know that date, you would have probably lost your position at King's. Because that is when, according to Christian theology, and this isn't a date picked out of this, this is Archbishop James Usher. He carefully studied the Bible, the original, the Hebrew Bible, went down, plotted every single incident in there, gave it approximate duration, wrote this book, drew this graph, and if he had PowerPoint, this is what he would make of it. So this is the level of detail he was able to capture in his treatise to tell you it was Saturday, 6 p.m., 4004 BC. Now, what you have to imagine is that in 1830, someone presenting you this, without PowerPoint, of course, would have absolutely captured your imagination because it would have looked deep and scholarly, and it would have tied with every single thing you know. Until comes along this man. So he's Professor Charles Lyell. He's the first professor of geology at King's in 1830, a time when King's did not, as I tell you, allow most of you to be a part of King's, but they did hire this person to be their professor of geology because at that point in time, there was nothing called geology. He wrote the textbook that's called Principles of Geology. And this man, standing in King's, actually showed this diagram. And he said, you know, this archbishop is all wrong. All you people of Christian faith with great belief in 4004, that's actually not how it happens. And when people asked him why, he turned around and he said, you know, I study rocks and I look at the various stratification of rocks. And he came up with a very complex argumentation that no one in that time really understood, is that he said through the study of geology, he could be pretty sure that the creation of mankind couldn't have happened just 6,000 years ago. Most of the people, well, they thought it was blasphemous. In fact, it was considered so dangerous that the college council passed an edict that yes, he could say what he wanted to say, but in a public lecture, if he said that, women were not allowed. I'm not kidding. This is true, because they felt this would be, you know, so disturbing to some people that they would not allow women and children into his public lectures, which all professors are, by the way, required to give a public lecture in the Great Hall. Why do I point this out? Why I point this out is because now, today, it's not a problem, because after him came Darwin. Darwin took this book on his beagle when he went around. Out of that came the theory of evolution. Now we know the Earth is, you know, maybe 4 billion or something old, and all of us say that with the same kind of certainty that people have said 4004 with the same kind of certainty. So I think being open to ideas, ideas that question your cherished beliefs, is very critically important. It's happened before. But the point is, when it happens, it's never pleasant. I cannot imagine that you were standing here questioning people's worldview with this abstract piece of information. So let me move you to the modern world. 31st of December, 1915. What else was happening in 1915? There was a world war going on. There was a world war going on, and for the very first time, there were people in universities beginning to question the basis of war. And those professors, this was largely in the United States, were actually feeling threats to their jobs. So on this particular day, this is the American Association of University Professors, got together and published what in modern terms is the nearest articulation of academic freedom and academic tenure. The idea that you won't get fired as a professor for having ideas that your community does not like, that even the rest of the professors don't like, that the state does not like, the government does not like. And in this particular case, one person who was a particular problem was a person called Scott Nearing. He was an economist at Wharton. Wharton at that point in time was funded by a lot of American corporate businessmen. You're talking about the roaring 1920s. It's that time. There was a lot of money. They did not like this socialist radical economist who was saying that the capital economy was not a good idea. And they did actually manage to get him to leave Wharton. So it was out of that came this idea of academic freedom. But let me then move you to 11th of May, 2023, London. Why is that important? Well, that's important because you got a new law. It's called the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. It came 11th of May, 2023, very recently. And that is important because we as a university have had to think about it and take seriously what it means for all of us. And therefore, in some sense, what we may have done a year or 2 years ago is different now that we understand this. So what does it say? It says that we as a university have a duty to take steps to secure freedom of speech for everyone, not just for professors, but staff, members of the provider, students, which is you, visiting speakers. So we've got to secure everyone's freedom of speech. And not only do we have to secure, we have to promote freedom of speech. And if we don't do it, we go to court, so we can be sued. But more importantly is a term here, which may not mean much to you. It's called ongoing registration. It means a lot to me, because that means they can shut us down. That's what it means, ongoing registration. That if we don't take this seriously, every year I have to go and get ongoing registration so that I can come back and you can come back each academic year. So this is serious. But this duty, of course, does not sit in isolation. We have another duty, and that's called the Equality Act, which defines something called harassment. Because if it was only one-sided, I could say, look, it's real academic freedom. You can see whatever you like on campus. No, you can't, because there are limits. And one of those limits is imposed by the Equality Act. And I'll let you read this. And please do take a moment to read this. Because it defines what harassment means. And I think all of us would say, yes, you know, we should preserve academic freedom, but of course we don't want anyone to harass anyone. Easy to say, until you now start dealing with the complexity. Harassment is perception of the person. So it's not what you said, it's how it was perceived. Now you might say, well, how could I be held responsible? I said something that was very innocent and sensible. This other person misunderstood it. So for your protection, it says whether it is reasonable for what you have said to have had that impact. How to reconcile these two is not easy, particularly when a protected characteristic can be a belief. Which belief? You know, religion itself is hard to kind of define and put boundaries around it. Is being vegan a belief? Is being vegan a protected belief? Okay. Is being gender critical a protected belief? It is. Is thinking that our climate is in crisis a protected belief? Is it? It is. In our law now, is being vegetarian a protected belief? I'm sorry? Sadly, no. Somehow, for reasons, look, talk to our law professors. Being vegan is a protected belief. Climate is in crisis is a protected belief. Being gender critical is... Being vegetarian is a lifestyle choice. So look, there is a bit of arbitrariness here until you will take someone to court, and then they'll probably have to concede if you make a good enough case, because for some, it's a part of their religion. So for Hindus, the belief in vegetarianism is a part of their religion. So all I'm pointing out is this is a very complex space we have to navigate together. And if it weren't complex enough here, because we are a public sector organization, so if I was a bank, this is all I have to worry about. But if I'm a public sector organization, I've got to do the academic freedom, I've got to do this, but I have a special public sector duty on top of that, which asks me to foster good relations between people who share a protected characteristic and people who don't. So I've got to make sure there are vegans and not vegans, or, you know, people who actually believe in gender in different ways. I have to foster good relationships between them. So interestingly enough, all of these are duties. So the point is, how do we navigate this complexity? And to make matters even more complicated, you all, as in students, also have complex beliefs about these matters. And this is the work done by King's Policy Institute, and I'm really pleased the real expert on this is Professor Bobby Duffy, so if you have any questions, ask him. But I want to actually show you one aspect of this finding. So this was a poll done to nearly 1,000 of UK university students in August of last year, and it said, it is important for the university to allow for all ideas and opinions to be expressed. And when we ask you all ideas and opinions, even if this means some students are offended, most of you are comfortable. Very few strongly disagree. Bad idea. Few of you do. You could say this is, you know, a lot of evidence in support. And if you were here for Professor Linda Woodhead's lecture, she spoke about offense and she helped you understand what it is. And I think she'd be pleased to see that most of you are comfortable that in a university, people can be offended by ideas and it's okay. But if we just ask that question a little bit differently, even if it means that students feel unsafe, and the emphasis I'm putting here is on feel unsafe, then most of you do not want those ideas expressed. Now, this is not about physical safety and security. This is about feeling unsafe. Who gets to decide that? Goes back to that harassment question. That is your perception. Is it reasonable? Who decides is it reasonable? So these are not easy questions, and I think we've got to find a path through this that has to somehow try to convert all of these complexities into something where we abide by our duties. Well, that's not a choice, really. We have to abide by our legal duties, but also is consistent with our values and the kind of community we would like to be. So how do we put all of this together? So I think the first thing that we as kings will do, and do indeed do, is ensure the safety and security for all on campus. And I've emphasized on campus, because we as a university are only in charge of our campus. And I have to point out subtle things like that as you go from the King's Building to the Bush House, you actually go from being on campus, not on campus, on campus again. So these are the realities of what we have to manage, and I think we're absolutely committed to this, your safety and security on campus. This comes first. To the degree that we can influence things beyond campus, we will try, in proportionality, but that cannot be our priority. It's not our jurisdiction. But the second duty is to secure and promote academic freedom. And it has to start with the default that any topic is allowed unless some special restrictions apply. And of course, those restrictions would be that it can't be hate speech, it can't be defamation, it can't be harassment, etc. But often, prospectively, you don't know. You know, no one comes in saying, you know what, I want to do hate speech. That's not how it works. It's in what they say. And in fact, they often passionately think that what they're saying is right. And if you feel it's hate speech, it's because you're having an unreasonable personal reaction. So these things aren't that simple. But I think our duty is not only to secure, but it's to promote academic freedom. And what that means is that we need to encourage scholarly discussion on contentious subjects. Because if we did not do that, we would not be fulfilling the role of a university. If we had asked Charles Lyell to just go away, as we did ask F.T. Maurice, who was another one of the professors here, a professor of theology at one time, to just go away, that would not be the right thing. So it is difficult, but we've got to find a way to encourage a scholarly discussion, and I'll come back to what is then a scholarly discussion. And if we are to do that, if we have to deliver on this duty to secure academic freedom, it is important that the university must be impartial. It doesn't require that you be impartial. You should have the academic freedom to take the views that you think are reasonable, so long as they don't violate one of the things above. But to allow each of you to take the views that you think are reasonable, it is important that the university be impartial. Because if I came in and said that, look, we've already decided it all started in 4004 BC, as an employee of this university or a student at this university, because of the power that the authorities have, you would actually naturally feel uncomfortable and restricted in expressing your point of view. So it is absolutely critical, if we are to deliver on our duty, to secure and promote academic freedom, which I tell you, even if it weren't a duty, is absolutely central to what a university is. It is important that the university be impartial, but impartial does not mean that we are indifferent. There is a lot of suffering in this world. The fact that we are impartial and do not take a political position on side does not mean that we are indifferent to it. Does not mean that in our own way we do not show our concern to our students and support them as they are affected by what is happening in the world. But that is different from the university taking a corporate position on a particular matter. So it is a value-based restraint. It is keeping quiet in the service of, not being complicit. And why we do that is because in our context as a university, as a community of ideas, as a scholarly community of ideas, this is a higher value to which we conform. Now, while we do that, we do wish to foster harmony in our scholarly community. And I want to be clear about the boundaries of this. We foster respect and we expect civility. Why do I use those words differently? Respect is in many ways an emotion. It is a state of mind in me towards you. It is something I choose to bestow upon you. You can't direct me to respect you. So while we will foster respect, we will ask each of you to be respectful towards each other, I can't actually require you to do that. I would dare say I can't even expect you to do that. If there are people who are going to hold really passionate but opposite views on, I don't know, veganism or something, I can't ask you to respect each other. I can expect you to be civil to each other, at least on campus. And that's the difference that I'm trying to emphasize. And what that is to mean, practically, is that the university is not the Hyde Park Speaker's Corner. How many of you have been to the Hyde Park Speaker's Corner? If you haven't in London, please do go. It is one of London's spectacles. But do go on a warm day. Don't go on a cold, rainy day. And you'll find people there passionately talking about things. So insofar as people at university are passionate, yes, that's the same. But after that, there are many things you don't see in Hyde Park. One is they never provide a reason and rationale for their position. Or if they do, it's a very one-sided reason and rationale. The second is they never seek balance. They never try to say, this is my position on whatever is the world's issue at this point in time. They feel very passionately about it. And then they just say the other side is just wrong and they just should be eliminated or they should go away. That's not the way a discussion should happen. That's not certainly a way a scholarly discussion should happen. But the big other difference is that in a scholarly discussion is an opportunity to ask questions and for the other person to respond to that question as best as they can engage. And I think in that spirit, I will give you time to ask me questions and I'll try to answer them as best as I can. But look, I'm emphasizing all of these things because when I take the complexity of the history of academic freedom, I take our health and safety duty to first ensure that the campus is a safe space. But then we could have a discussion. I'm talking about safe. What about psychological safety? I have to say that gets complicated. If you say, I did not promise you a psychologically safe campus. Now, this is where being a psychiatrist, probably I do have something to say. Because first, I cannot define what a psychologically safe campus is. And if anyone starts using this word psychologically safe, as people often do, you're usually misusing it if you mean it in the technical term. Because the technical term arose because of a work of a professor, Amy Edmondson, in organizational theory of businesses, where she meant psychologically safe was a team in a company where you were allowed to question your boss, where questions were openly asked. It was not that she meant a place where no one ever got bothered. So we will try to ensure safety and security. We will create the space for academic freedom. To do that, the university will remain impartial on most, but I will say not all and ever issues. So it is not that anything goes in the name of academic freedom. You can obviously not do things like hate speech, defamation, harassment, But even though it's not written in law, we will stand here and ensure that all people's rights to exist are respected insofar in the discourse of the university community. I cannot control the world outside, but there can be limits on discourse here. So it is not anything goes. We will foster respect, but we will expect civility. And there is a difference between fostering and expect. And if you push me, what I would say is we would deal with misconduct when it happens. But I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope it is about expecting civility, and you will grant that to your colleagues. And then what a scholarly community does is provide reason and rationale for your position. I've tried to present in the way that I could some reason and rationale to why we've come to this, to seek balance and to ask and to respond to questions. So on that, I think we are within time. I thank you for your time, and I hope that you will now question me in the spirit. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.